We're reading excerpts of Marx's 18th Brumaire and Emmanuel Wallerstein's The Modern World System for Centrist Liberalism Triumphant, 1789 to 1914, in order to see the origins of the modern centralist bureaucratic nation state in the fixed determination of statesmen to repress us, we the people, in order to see. We're reading in order to see that it is a new invention, the nation state, and we can uninvent it. An invention of self-conscious global statesmen, a construction requiring that we remain as children, dependent on the adult for our existence. And this is where Kropotkin is at, totally. I keep adding a little bit more, so I hope you note the draft number of the PDF of his. I'm going to be sharing three excerpts of three of his essays in that PDF. I hope you check him out because I totally vibe with where he's at because he is too through with seeing all of our power dissipated, just thrown away because of deep conditioning to obey. You know, so he's given us a good shake in those essays and a clear historical analysis to explain how power tamed us. Once we see how the thing is done, we can decide that we don't want to go along is the point. And never before has this construction called the state has our necks in a noose been as vulnerable as today to our interventions toward its delegitimization due to the internet. This means that our discussions with the broader community will have some degree multiplied the impact as ever was before. And we're reading Wallerstein to help us get clear as we design our education work with the broader community, because that's what this is about. This isn't about us huddling together and commiserating with each other at the sad state of the world. Far from it. This is about celebrating our new expanded capacity to transform the world, and that we got to spread the good news, pull as many in as possible, and that means education redesign. We have to tackle in that design the notion of progress, because that's key. That's key propaganda for the power gods. It's their raison d'etre and self-justification. And Emmanuel Wallerstein is showing us, particularly with Alice Miller's additional light, how the notion of progress is indeed but the notion of class, crafted for slick installation in our heads. The con that progress increases as class deepens by means of education trained in us by our parents when we're infants, and from thence to society overall, globally. It is in the light of our potential for the infinite expansion of our gifts that we need to see Guizot's tactic of our categorization, society's fragmentation, see it as conscious political strategy to destroy the power of self-developing individualities, for it is as individualities that we claim our bodies. Each one of us is precious and unique. And before the statesman can throw us away like garbage by manufacturing war, disease, and scarcity, this being the reality of their progress, we must first throw ourselves away. This took time. It was not our natural inclination. Naturally, we are big. The more we grow our gifts, the more we resist this notion of subsuming them. And it had been our habit to pass this capacity on to our children. So power decided it must be broken, this expression of and capacity for our gifts, continuous growth, broken with the propaganda of class and progress and of class equals progress. So let's turn now to Emanuel Wallerstein's Modern World System 4. Quote, "The distinction made by modern scholars between artisans and factory workers seems to be asserted primarily on the basis of differing workplace organization." And we've been arguing, as I just said, that class is a construction, an ideology that serves propagandistic purposes of power. It needs to put us in, they hope, mutually exclusive categories. They like neat, strict, rigid categorization. And so they one of the things they set about doing in the aftermath of the French Revolution, as they began to figure out ways to control us permanently using Bentham's notion of the panopticon, which we discussed in other shows, is developing this taxonomy, this notion of putting us in a box and training us to think in terms of boxes. So, continuing, "In fact, the artisans were usually in workshops, which weren't all that different in structure and even social organization from the rather small factories that existed in this era. I suspect the real difference was in the origins of the two groups. The artisans were males, and males who came from the most part from the immediate area. The factory workers were largely either women and children, and boy, do they not want us to all get together." That's been their MO from day one. Day one, since class begun. "Were migrants," continuing, "which included both those who came from rural communities and workers speaking another language." And that, of course, is never by accident when that occurs. "The most dramatic expression of protest by the artisans was that of the Canuts of Lyon, first in 1831 and then in 1834. The struggles began right after the July Revolution and included, and I'm not certain if we covered that bit, but there was a lot of slaughter, a lot of repression to, in which the rising middle class decided that they needed order. They didn't want us getting all uppity because of the French Revolution, thinking that we deserved to actually be free. Oh, no, no, no. So these struggles in Lyon began right after the July Revolution and included machine destruction and eviction of foreign workers. The background to this was an 18th century militancy of journeymen, which had erupted in 1786 in the so-called Tuppenny Riot, in which the journeymen sought to obtain a fixed minimum rate for finished cloth. The ongoing turmoil continued up to the French Revolution and the enactment of the Loi du Chapelier. Bazucha concludes that the French Revolution, in fact, broke the momentum created prior to 1789. It may have retarded the development of a workers' movement in Lyon. In the years between 1789 and 1830, however, the relatively stable system of the Compagnon had been replaced by a more fluid one of piece work laborers. Levasseur asks the question, why Lyon? Why 1831? His answer is that Lyon was living off a luxury industry, silk, which made it more sensitive to economic crises and political turmoil. The immediate issue, as in 1786, was a minimum wage, which had been agreed to by the prefect, but subsequently revoked by the central government. The first strike was relatively non-political, but discontent continued. There was a strike in Paris in 1832. The atmosphere was more and more politicized, partly by the dissatisfaction of the working classes with the politics of the July monarchy, partly, at least in Lyon, by the agitation of the Italian nationalist forces. Mazzini's aide-de-camp, General Romorino, was often in Lyon, recruiting persons for their attempts to liberate Savoy and Piedmont. On February 14, 1834, a general strike was called. It did not succeed. The local Republican Party was divided in its attitude. A repressive law caused a further reaction by the workers in April, an uprising in which some 300 were killed. This attempt came to be viewed as a landmark in the history of the European working class. This time, the repression by the authorities was definitive. There was a monster trial in 1835, which the government used to get rid of the Republicans. And by Republicans, we're talking about those who supported the French Revolution, who believed they were actually going to achieve freedom for the everyday folk. Faced with the beginnings of a serious class struggle by the urban working class, the liberal state initially reacted as repressively as did its predecessors. The story was not different, and was not very different in Great Britain. The moral equivalent of the July Revolution was the Reform Bill of 1832. Great Britain didn't know those three glorious days of revolution. Instead, there was a parliamentary battle in which the revolution was voted in on the crucial second reading in 1831 by a single vote. When, despite this, the bill was defeated in committee, the Reform Bill, Parliament was dissolved and a pro-reform parliament elected. At the time, there was great awareness of events in France and the possibilities of worse happening. Macaulay's speech on March 2, 1831, in favor of reform, makes clear the reasoning of those who advocated it. Quote, "Turn where we may, within, around, the voice of great events is proclaiming to us reform, that you may preserve, renew the youth of the state. Save property divided against itself. Save the multitude endangered by its own ungovernable passions. Save the aristocracy endangered by its own unpopular power. Save the greatest and fairest and most highly civilized country that ever existed from calamities that may in a few days sweep away all the rich heritage of so many ages of wisdom and glory. The danger is terrible. The time is short. If this bill should be rejected, I pray to God that none of those who concur in rejecting it ever remember their votes with unavailing remorse. Amidst the wreck of laws, the confusion of ranks, the spoliation of property, and the dissolution of social orders," unquote, from Macaulay. Macaulay's argument was heard. And exactly as in France, once the middle strata had won their droit de cité, attention turned immediately to containing the claims of the working classes. Chartism, much the most important movement of working men and a continuation of the old radical reform movement, was contemporaneous with and strongest during the Great Industrial Depression from 1837 to 1843. It gained considerable notoriety and seemed a real menace to the authorities for several years. A large part of Chartist ranks were drawn from members of trade societies, but it also had support from middle-class radicals. The Chartist movement existed simultaneously with and was in direct rivalry with the free trade movement of the Anti-Corn Law League. Halevy raises the specter of a potential for civil war. Briggs speaks of the two movements as representing a contrast between two segments of a divided society. Gash says of the movement, a phrase borrowed from continental politics, that it had an undeniable air of class war.